This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 High FM.
101.9 High FM. This is the late afternoon Erev Shabbos show. My name is Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, and a warm, warm welcome to all of you staying with us who have joined us today on this late, late Friday afternoon as we come into another beautiful, beautiful Shabbos Kodesh. Oh, what an opportunity. Baruch Hashem, we've gone through another week. Baruch Hashem, hopefully it was a successful and an upbeat kind of week for you. But now we've reached the crescendo. We've reached Shabbos Kodesh. Baruch Hashem, this is, of course, a big Shabbos Chazak. We're going to finish Sefer Bamidbar. Only one more Sefer to go before we actually finish the Torah again. And it's so wonderful to have this chus to spend time with you on this beautiful, beautiful Erev Shabbos. Of course, as always, our program is brought to you as a refuah shleima for people nebuch that are ill, some local people. Just for example, Shmuel Chaim ben Ella Devora, Yishai ben Devora Leah, Omri ben Enat, and Yehuda Hillel ben Shulamis Leah, Tzivia bas Malka, Yehudis Brocha bas Rochel, Esther bas Tzipora, Devora Yocha bas Mira, Beseich Shor Choyle Yisrael, anyone, Taka, who's in need of a divine little kiss, of a little extra help, of a little something from the Rabbeinu Shlom, may the schus of us coming together and spending time to learn Torah, to get involved in trying to strengthen ourselves in our emunah and our Kadosh Baruch Hu, and our knowledge and understanding of the Torah, give us something to say over at the table to give our family a sort of chizuk with, is such an important thing. May that be a zchus to help all those who may need something from the Rebbeinu Shlom, which of course is all of us. The parsha begins by talking about the laws of promises, and the very first pasuk says, "Lo yachel devarei." A person may not desecrate his word. You know, it's not sort of defiling one's power of speech. So, consists of actually two aspects, negative and positive, right? One who cheapens or denigrates his speech, so allows for kind of a spiritual sort of corrosion to set in, just as rust sets in on metal, and just as rust kind of dulls and weakens a once kind of sharp, smooth utensil, so also the sort of coarsening of language impedes the spiritual power of a person's words. Even when one seeks to do the right thing, to reach out and help his fellow, to sort of offer words of encouragement, uplifting words that would inspire and help him to sort of extricate himself from whatever sort of situation, difficulty a person is in, the influence for good, the power to inspire, lacks the clarity and fire it once possessed. His own negligence has spiritually kind of compromised his power of speech. And yeah, of course, we acknowledge at the same time a corresponding and profound benefit to not desecrating one's speech. Such a person elevates his power of speech and strengthens his unique Hashem-given faculty and almost imbues it with almost an added dimension of sacredness, together with the sort of the kedusha, right? That sound that emanates from his mouth, so that grants the sound very, very great, unique spiritual properties and a capability to affect, to inspire, and to bring about meaningful change. When someone who guards his speech speaks, people listen. His mouth is now an instrument, a medium through which bracha, blessing, inspiration, and truth can actually flow through quite effectively. right? The mouth is much more than a vehicle for just communication. It's an instrument from which Kedusha can flow, right? When guarded, it elevates the speaker. When neglected, it diminishes him. And we wonder why some sort of prolific orators don't impact their listeners, right? They don't create a kind of an enduring change in their congregants, while others, whose power of speech maybe leaves much to be desired, right? Who lack that, I don't know, the pizzazz and the sort of elan that allows the speaker to sort of control and inspire his crowd. And yet, they do just that. It's all in the kedusha of the mouth. Pure spring water flowing through rusty pipes doesn't taste so good. Plain water in purified pipes is actually very refreshing. This is 101.9 Chai FM. The program is the late afternoon. Erev Shabbos Shalom. My name is Rav Moshe Schnurb. We'll be back in a moment with much, much more.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
101 Chai FM. This is the late afternoon Erev Shabbos show with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb. Welcome back for those who are joining us now. We are talking about the Parsha Hashavua, the Parsha of this week, as we imminently approach the onset of Shabbos Kodesh. One of the major topics that's dealt with in the first of our double parshas, we have two parshas this week, Matot and Maaseh, with so much content, it's virtually impossible to even try to cover all of it. So I'm going to focus on one issue, as we try each year to focus on another major issue. If you go back to the archives, we've, Baruch Hashem, covered a lot of different topics on each parsha. So one of the main discussions in the whole second half of the first parsha is the quest by two and a half of the tribes of Israel to acquire for themselves a inheritance place on the east bank of the Jordan River. And it starts with Mikne Rav, right? The tribe of Reuven, the tribe of God, had very, very numerous amounts of cattle, of flocks, and as a result, they saw the land of the east bank of the Jordan, where the Jewish nation currently was camped. They had just been victorious in wars over the Amorite kings of Sihon and Og, and they were there. And they saw that this land so incredibly well suited them. It was so beautiful. It was such great pasture for all of the animals. And therefore, they came forward to Moshe Rabbeinu initially requesting permission that they should not be forced to go into Israel at all. They should be allowed to inherit land on the east bank of the Jordan River. As we know, Moshe Rabbeinu balked at that. He kind of almost went ballistic at them, accusing them basically of being just like the spies, who also did not want to go into the land of Israel. And then they came back with a new negotiating tactic and said, okay, fine. We will go with you. We will lead the Jews into battle. We will help the Jewish nation capture the land of Israel. We will even remain behind while they divide up the land. And then we'll go back to our homes on the east bank of the Jordan and live there. And that Moshe Rabbeinu agreed with. And, you know, from this whole story of these children of God and Reuven, which is mentioned here at length in the Torah, we learn a very, very important lesson that earlier in the parasha, we discussed the revenge war that the Jews had against the kingdom of Midian. Midian had been responsible for inciting the Jews to sin, and many Jews had died, and Hashem commanded them to take revenge on them and fight them before Moshe Rabbeinu left this world. One of his last acts of valor was to lead that battle. He didn't actually lead the battle, but he was obviously the CEO. So after this war against Midian, So the and there was lots of obviously in that war there was lots of booty, lots of spoils taken from the enemy. So these tribes, Reuben and Gad, ended up with tremendous amounts of cattle, much more even than all of the other tribes, and therefore that was the basis of them asking Moshe Rabbeinu that they should be able to remain on the east bank of the Jordan River, which of course was a very, very fertile land, perfect for their sheep, in order that there would be enough food for their animals. And there's several questions we need to ask on this whole episode. Number one, what caused why did Hashem bring it about and allow it that the tribes of Reuben and Gad should have so much more cattle than all of the other tribes? Right? Obviously, basically when they left Egypt 40 years earlier, basically they had wealth, they had things they had taken from the Egyptians, borrowed what they got from the spoils of the Red Sea, but they were all on some sort of a comparable level of wealth. And even from this final war against Midian, so the Torah goes into detail how the booty and spoils were divided equally against the soldiers, against the Kohanim, against the rank and file. So everyone sort of seems to have received a fair and equal share of what there was. So how did these two Shvatim, Reuven and Gad, suddenly end up with so much more in terms of flocks and cattle than anybody else? Question number two, while we mention the two tribes, the tribes of Reuven and Gad, it actually wasn't two tribes. It was actually two and a half tribes. Half of the tribe of Menashe also joined the tribe of Reuven and Gad, and they sort of willingly took the decision to separate themselves from the other half, sort of to break away from the rest of their tribe, the tribe of Menashe, in order that they also should not have to enter Eretz Yisrael, and they could also stay on the far side. And it seems strange. Where? What? Why? Why did they get involved in this episode? If the rest of the tribe didn't want to, why did they suddenly want to? So it's interesting. In order to actually be able to answer these questions and to sort of really be able to get some kind of a basic understanding of what was actually going on here, so we need to go back and learn a little bit from something the Arizal actually says, and is actually brought in the Sefer of the Likutei of the Ari on this week's parasha. And by understanding, as often is so true, one has to understand a little bit of the depth of the matter, and then we can sort of get an insight into with the scope kind of what is actually happening, and this will help us perhaps understand overall what the whole story was. So we need, and as often as we see with these things, one needs to go back to the very beginnings of people's history, of the makeup of people, and understand what kind of motivates and motors them, and then often we can understand a little bit more about what they do and why they would do it. So let's take, for example, Reuven. So he was one of these two tribes. So often from the beginnings of a person, we learn a tremendous amount of insight about them and are able sometimes to fathom and understand a little bit about the way they operate. So if you go back to the very first information that we learn about Reuven, so we go back to the book of Bereishis, to chapter 29, Psukim 21, Chav Aleph and Chav Hei. So it says there that Lavan was, of course, where Yaakov had to flee when Esav was chasing him. Lavan, of course, being the father of the two women he eventually married, Rachel and Leah. So Lavan promised Yaakov that he was going to give him his daughter Rachel as a wife in exchange for 7 years of work that Yaakov Avinu would work for his sheep, to take care of his sheep. And as we know, of course, on the night of the chuppah, so Lavan tricked Yaakov, and instead of presenting to him his wife that he was supposed to be marrying, which was Rachel, he brought in her place her older sister, Leah. And on that very first night that they were together, Leah became pregnant, right? Of course, Yaakov at that point was unaware who he was with, and he only became aware of the sort of the ruse when he woke up in the morning when it got light. So it comes out that the inception of Reuven was without the knowledge of Yaakov, that he thought that he was actually being together with Rachel at that night. And because of that act, so there was a certain imperfection in the pregnancy of Reuven. And in fact, the whole relationship with his mother Leah was flawed, because he walked with her to the chuppah and wasn't even aware, and didn't even want to actually be there, and didn't have knowledge of it. Let's take a break and come back and perhaps discuss this a bit further. This is 101.9. The program is Late Afternoon Erev Shabbos Show. My name is Rabbi Moshe Shlomo. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Shnerb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
101.9, this is Chai FM. This is the Late Afternoon Erev Shabbos Show with Rabbi Moshe Shnerb. We are talking about the Pasha, we are talking about the roots of the tribes of Reuven and Gad, where Reuven was actually conceived in a situation of sort of a deep secrecy, where Yaakov Avinu thought he was actually marrying Leah's sister Rachel, and unbeknownst to him, his dear father-in-law had swapped the girls, and he was actually marrying Leah. And therefore, when he conceived on that night from Leah, unaware even that he was conceiving from her, obviously the child that was conceived was Reuven, but that is considered to have been done in a little bit of a spirit of subterfuge, of not exactly the proper way, the proper intention, the proper holiness that a child should be confused. And as I say, in the relationship with Leah, it also, this was a wedding that took place without the knowledge even of the husband. And therefore, again, somehow in the interpersonal relationships in the Ben Odom LaChavera, that also would have created some type of a problematic a relationship. And the truth is, if we look at the roots of the tribe of Gad, it's also slightly similar, because Rachel, in frustration that she was not able to have any children, and seeing that Leah had actually given her maidservant Zilpah to Yaakov as a wife also, so therefore she also gave her maidservant Bilhah, that she should be a wife to Yaakov and bear him children. There was, though, a difference, says the Ari, in that, as we said, Rachel gave her maidservant Bilhah with a full acquiescence and agreement of Yaakov, but Leah wasn't so forthcoming. And it seems that, as he says, that on a night that Leah was scheduled to have been together with Yaakov, she kind of substituted Zilpah in the bed instead of her, and therefore she spent the night with Yaakov. And again, unbeknownst to Yaakov Avinu, and again from that pregnancy, she became pregnant, and from that pregnancy was born the child Gad. So therefore, we see even that even in the connection of God was also this slight type of a perfection, a child conceived in a concealed and not so straightforward kind of way. And again, it was a bit of a trick on Yaakov, playing with him in substituting the women. So they fooled Yaakov against his knowledge. Now, this teeny little bit of a shortcoming in the very, very beginning of the existence of these holy Shvatim, right? Because their creation wasn't exactly with pure knowledge and pure agreement from the side of Yaakov, that he thought that in both cases that he was actually sleeping with a different woman. That was enough, says the Arizal, to prevent their descendants from being able to be merit to the greatest gift of all, the greatest inheritance, which is, of course, the great privilege of being able to settle in the land of Israel. That the complete and total holiness and kedusha of the land that is really what is the essence of the land of Israel doesn't put up, can't stomach, can't bear something which isn't perfect. And therefore, even though the other tribes who were complete had the right to settle in the land of Israel, they were actually denied that right. Now, so that really explains the very, very inception of Reuven and Gad. The whole sort of situation around Menashe is a little bit more complicated, because the Chazal explained to us that his mother, the mother of Menashe, was actually Asnas. Asnas was the daughter of Dina, who was impregnated by Shechem, the son of Hamor, as Targum Yonason in Parshat Miketz Springs, and it's also brought down in the Das Akenim Mibale Tosis. Comes out, therefore, that the inception of Asnas was also kind of a little bit mixed up with something that was impure, with Shechem, who was not a Jewish person, and having a union together with someone who was pure, which was Dinah, the daughter of Yaakov. And therefore, at the time when Asnas became pregnant from Yosef, so in Menashe was sort of a little bit mixed up, a little portion of the genealogy of Shechem, who was the father of his mother. And therefore, again, since half of him came from Yosef, who was absolutely pure, and half came from this little bit of imperfection, therefore it was decreed on half of the tribe of Menashe that they would not merit to go into inherit in the land of Israel, because since there was sort of mixed up within them a little bit from the root, the evil root of this man Shechem, and it's not a 100% pure situation. However, Ephraim, the younger child who was born after Menashe, so he was already completely pure and clean from any effect from Shechem, because at the time when Menashe, his older brother, was born, so whatever needed to sort of leave the family a fold from his mother Asnas, all of that was injected into Menashe, and there was just absolute a purity and cleanliness that was the makeup of his younger brother Ephraim, and therefore he merited to be in Eretz Yisrael. So this is the opinion of the Arizal, and the Chidah in his Sefer Yosef Lekach, he comes and actually adds on and explains that in spite of the fact that this was a decree from Hashem that the members of these two tribes would not be able to come into Eretz Yisrael because their state of holiness is not complete enough to be able to dwell in that rarefied space. Nevertheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not want to embarrass them and to kind of reveal this imperfection, and therefore he had tremendous, Hashem always has compassion on the dignity and honor of these great people, and therefore he sort of manipulated the situation that they themselves would get up and they would ask to settle on the east bank of the Jordan and not go into Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, the members of these two Shvatim didn't come to make this request only after the war against Midian, because this was like sort of the very, very last stage, right? Before Moshe Rabbeinu, in fact, as we know, the war of Midian, Torah says, you fight the war against Midian, and afterwards, Moshe Rabbeinu was going to die. So they knew they were in the very, very last throes of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, which means that, and immediately subsequent to that, they were going to be entering the land of Israel. Right, and as we said, that's in fact what HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded Moshe, that he must fight this war before he dies. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sort of caused that specifically at that time, where the booty of these 2.5 tribes, Hashem caused that they would have a huge, huge amount of cattle, much more than all of the other tribes, in order that, because of that, that would place in their minds this necessity that was created, of course, by actions that happened many years before, this necessity, and that they would have to ask for the land on the east bank of the Jordan and not in Eretz Yisrael. So we come out, therefore, that we see now from the actions of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how far HaKadosh Baruch Hu's compassion, how far HaKadosh Baruch Hu's care for the honor and dignity of people actually goes. That in spite of the fact that there already was, as the Arizal said, a decree that they would not be able to go into Eretz Yisrael and get a piece of land there, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu did it in such a kind way that it would be in such a way that they themselves were the impetus for this. Not that it was sort of rammed down their throat as a punishment, but they themselves came and instigated a process where they would be allowed to settle on the east bank. Let's add a little bit more, perhaps, regarding the dividing up of the tribe of Menashe into two. Chazal actually explain. It's a Medrash Rabbah in Bereishis in Perik Pei Dalet 84. The Medrash gives an additional reason besides the reason that we mentioned in the name of the Arizal, right? Because the division, they say that the division of the tribe of Menashe comes, what he calls Mida Kenegan Mida. Right? It's quid pro quo situation. Because of the fact that Menashe, the progenitor, the tribe, the actual Menashe himself, he caused that the Shvatim had to tear their clothing. When was this? This was when Menashe was sent by his father Yosef. Right, this was back in Mitzrayim. Menashe, who was Yosef's sort of 2IC, his kind of right hand man in running Egypt. So Menashe was sent by his father Yosef to hide Yosef's so-called magic goblet in the sack of Binyamin. And when he then later sort of caught up with them and the brothers realized what had happened and that in fact, Binyamin was now being accused of stealing Yosef's cup. So the Torah says, Karu es bigdeim. They tore their clothing. And because of that pain that was caused to all of the holy Shvatim, that they had to tear their clothing, and again, for no reason at all. This was all a ruse. This was all part of Yosef's plan to hopefully get Yaakov to come down to Mitzrayim, which is what he really wanted. But because of the fact that, because of his action, the all the other Shvatim had to tear their clothing. Therefore, says the Medrash, their inheritance was also torn into two. Half was in Eretz Yisrael and half was in the Eivre Yarden. So again, this teaches us another important lesson on the severity of the punishment one can receive because of a slight deviation, a slight imperfection in created in interpersonal relationships, and any pain that we cause to another person. In other words, the descendants of Menashe were punished because of the sin that their father sinned, which was really sort of 250 years actually before this, right? And in fact the essence of that sin was the fact that he caused his brother a little bit of upset, a little bit of pain, a little bit of sorrow, even though he was actually simply carrying out the command of his father. Nevertheless, it was then appropriate that Menashe should have said, no, please, this is going to be painful for the brothers. Send someone else. But he didn't, because he was the agent that created this pain in their personality and that they had to, tear their clothing. And that, therefore, he was punished in this way, that his inheritance was torn up also. Now, this is another similar sort of situation that's perhaps a little bit similar to the situation we have here of the birth of Reuven and Gad. We find in Chazal also that regarding the birth of David HaMelech, of King David, right? So that also was quite similar, as it's brought in the Sefer Yosef Tehillos, which the Chidah brings, quoting a Medrash, that the father of David HaMelech, Yishai, right, who was again the grandson of Rusa Moivia, he was a little bit worried. Maybe Boaz, who had ruled that Rus was allowed to marry a Jewish man, maybe Bayaz and his Beis Din had perhaps made a mistake when they paskin that a Moabite woman was allowed to marry a Jew, and therefore they allowed Rus to enter the Jewish nation. And therefore, Yishai separated from his own wife after he already had 6 sons and 2 daughters. He then separated his wife. And even though he never actually divorced her, he never gave her a get, in spite of that, he kind of, he freed. He had a non-Jewish maid, and they freed the non-Jewish maid on condition. And after he freed his wife, he then took this maid as a wife. Now his own wife, who was a very, very righteous woman, who still wanted one more child from her husband Yishai, so she made an agreement with the maids that they would swap one night, and instead of the maid being, or the former maid was now the wife, being with David, actually his original wife was with him. And on that night, they conceived David HaMelech, right? Again, but without the full knowledge and consent of Yishai. Yishai and his other sons, who didn't know from this whole swap, thought he was born out of wedlock and excommunicated him for 28 years until Shmuel came and anointed him as the king. From all these stories, we see how serious a matter is, how careful. And we're in the 3 weeks now, the weeks that commemorate the destruction of the temple, how careful we have to be not to insult, not to hurt other people. And even when we're doing it for the right reasons, right? Yishai separated from his wife because he thought that maybe he wasn't allowed to be married, right? As we saw. Nevertheless, it's considered an imperfection, and Hashem punishes for that. Let's make an effort, particularly this time, to put more effort, to put a little bit more care into the way we talk, into the way we speak, into the way we handle, into the way we actually deal with those people we come in contact with, and please God, bring about the resurrection and the rebuilding of our close relationship with Hashem. This is 101.9. The program is the late afternoon Erev Shabbos show. My name is Rav Moshe Schnurb. We'll be back in a moment with our Hilchos Shabbos slot.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
101.9 Chai FM. This is the late afternoon Erev Shabbos show with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb. Welcome those who are joining us right now as we stand on the precipice of an amazing, amazing new Shabbos, ready to sort of dive into it and let it surround us. And as we always do at this time on the show, just to let you know the important details and times and nuances you might need to know for this coming Shabbos. So first and foremost, the earliest time to light candles this afternoon will be just now at 4:24. 4:24 is the earliest time we can do our lich benching this afternoon, and it's, as I always tell you, it's a very, very special thing if you can manage. I know the Fridays are still short, although we've gotten already about 8 minutes longer than it was at its earliest. But you know, we can definitely do it. Get things organized. Have the kids maybe even, I don't know if that's a dirty word, have the kids sort of pitch in and help a little bit, maybe even more than they normally do. Get Shabbos ready, get the food out, get the house ready, get yourselves bathed and dressed, and allow Shabbos into your life as soon as possible. 4:24 is the earliest. If you can't manage then, 4:30, 4:45, all great. The latest time and the actual beginning of Shabbos this afternoon is at 5:13. 5:13 is the latest, is the deadline for lighting our Shabbos candles. You know that as far as we're concerned, that is the absolute end. We have to have everything ready, food hot, to get all the mukzah things away, to finish showering, etc., etc. That's really when Shabbos comes into our lives. Yes, of course, there are the 18 minutes until sunset, but those are, again, always just an emergency situation for someone who, God forbid, is really in a crisis mode. And if not for those 18 minutes, might actually come to, God forbid, break Shabbos, we give them that time. But as far as normal situations are concerned, 5:13 is the absolute deadline for us to have all of our Shabbos things, ready. The sunset then is at 5:31. 5:31 is already sunset. That's the absolute latest, even in emergency situations. And therefore, of course, if you want to make sure that when you daven Ma'ariv, you're davening at night, and you can then fulfill the mitzvah of saying the Kriyat Shema in its correct time and reading Kriyat Shema when it's proper night, all you have to do is wait until 5:49. 5:49 is already nightfall, and you can daven Ma'ariv, hopefully, obviously, in shul with a minyan, and then come home, and you still have a glorious, glorious long night to spend together with the family, have a beautiful, hot Shabbos meal with some good Torah and some good discussion and some good singing, and just a beautiful family time together, maybe with some friends around the table also, and really, really make it a beautiful time. When you finish the meal, again, don't just sort of collapse. You don't need to sleep a whole donut. As I say, a croissant is always going to be enough. And let's spend a bit of time, open a book, open a sefer. You know, there's a lot of parsha to get through this week, 244 psukim of it. So if you haven't sort of gotten through most of it, definitely worthwhile to put an hour to the books and go through the psukim and go through Rashi and get a handle of it on this week's parsha. So again, tomorrow, of course, is the reading of the final two parshiot of Parshas Bamidbar, Matos and Masei. And of course, we say Chazak, Chazak at the end of Masei. It's a very, 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 very interesting learning. Lots and lots to talk about, lots and lots to read about. And let's take advantage. Of course, the Haftarah for tomorrow is the second Haftarah of the dire sort of warnings and predictions about the demise of the Jewish nation. In the Chumashim, it's the Haftarah of Parshas Masseh, the second chapter of Yirmiyahu. And it sets the tone, because please God, the next thing that happens after Haftarah is, of course, it is Shabbos Mevorchim, but Shabbos Mevorchim for Chodesh Menachem Av. And of course, the Rosh Chodesh, which is going to be on Tuesday, not Wednesday, is also the beginning of the more severe 9-day mourning period leading up to Tisha B'Av, which of course will be a week from Wednesday night and Thursday day. So it gets us a bit into the mood. Obviously, if your congregation, your shul, has certain things they do on the Shabbos of Orachim, a special chant, a special shir, whatever it might be, get involved. You know, be part of it. Don't be a standoff. It's really important to be part of a community, part of a kehila, and feel the energy, feel the incredible power of being part of a kehila. So we will then say Kiddush Birchas HaChodesh, or Shchodesh being, as I say, one day, just on Wednesday, and even though it is Shabbos Avorachim, because it is during the 3 weeks, we still say Avrachamim in Musaf, and we then, the afternoon carries on. We're back to the beginning of Pirkei Avot, back to Perek Aleph, back to the first chapter. And again, another chance to go through it and review it. And maybe last time you learned the first couple of Mishnayos. So start from there. Start from, we tend to always start doing things. We don't necessarily finish. We might learn the first four or five Mishnayos and then we never get back to it. Now you have a chance to get back to it. You can do 5 to 10 this week. And maybe next cycle, you'll do to the end of it. Get through all of it. It's very, very worthwhile. And Shabbos Kodesh ends tomorrow night at 6:05. 6:05 is the end of Shabbos. And as I say, we go into a week that on Wednesday picks up Rosh Chodesh and the beginning of the 9 days of mourning. We are talking about animals on Shabbos, the laws of one's animals, which we know one is required to rest on Shabbos. So we said a Jew is allowed to allow a non-Jew to actually ride, let's say, his horse or other animal on Shabbos. And this is based on an interesting principle, which really says that the chai noseis atzmai, a living being, actually carries it itself. So therefore, the non-Jew who rides the animal is not considered actually a burden that the animal is carrying him, nor are even the clothes that he wears, because they are considered sort of secondary to his body. However, Chazal made a decree that a Jew may not use an animal at all on Shabbat. In other words, he may not lean on the animal, he may not place an object on the animal, or even sit in a wagon that's kind of hitched to an animal, even if a non-Jew is actually driving the wagon for his own purposes, as the Shulchan Aruch says in Siman 3:305. Right? And the reason for this is, and the reason why the rabbis made a special enactment, is to avoid kind of burdening the animal on Shabbos, says the Gemara in Beitza. Another reason is that while riding an animal, one, of course, may come to break off a tree branch, right, in order to sort of goad the animal, and that would transgress the Torah obligation of kotzer, of cutting off something from its growing source, which one certainly is not allowed to do. A Jew may not take another Jew's animal outside of the tchum of Shabbos, outside the 2,000 amos that a person is allowed to go beyond the city. Now, this tchum is based on the tchum of the animal's owner. In other words, if the owner, wherever the owner of that animal would be allowed to go on Shabbos, his animal is also allowed to go. If the owner entrusted the animal to a kind of a shepherd, whether Jewish or non-Jewish, so then the tchum is based on that of the actual shepherd. Now, the prohibition is only for the animal to leave the tchum, right, at the initiative of its owner. Right? It is not sort of prohibited for the animal to leave of its own sort of volition, or for a non-Jewish shepherd to take it outside of the tchum. We're going to come back with some last-minute comments after the break. This is 101.9. The program is the late afternoon Erev Shabbos. My name is Moshe Shterb, and this is the greatest Jewish radio station in all of Africa.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Shnerb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
101.9 Chai FM. This is the late afternoon Erev Shabbos show, Rabbi Moshe Shnerb. A warm welcome if you're joining us just at the tail end of our time together. We are talking about animals on Shabbos. And as we've seen, one must allow animals to rest on Shabbos. This includes making sure that one's animal does not enter a sort of even a semi-public, what we call a carmelis, or a public place, a what's called a Rishus HaRabim, with a burden on his back. However, not everything an animal carries is considered to be a burden. Just as, let's say, a human being, right, is allowed to go out even into a public place wearing his clothes because they are considered sort of secondary to his body, so too a donkey, let's say, suffering from the cold, may be taken outside wearing a sort of a pack saddle, right? That's meant to warm it, right? Other animals, though, which do not suffer from the cold, may not be taken outside with a saddle, says the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Shinhei. Similarly, a dog that is wrapped in an article of clothing may not be taken outside. Why? Since it does not truly need this, the clothing is considered carrying. It's considered a burden. If one is not taking the dog outside, one may, of course, dress it, as there's no prohibition to carry in the house, to carry in your private property. One may take out an animal that is wearing sort of a bandage to protect an injury, or a sheep that's wearing a cover designed to keep its wool from getting dirty. Right? This is, of course, on condition that they are tightly bound to the animal with no possibility that they will fall off. Right? And that ensures that no one will end up carrying them in a either semi-public or a public area. One may not take out an animal with a muzzle that is meant to prevent the animal from grazing in other people's fields. That's because the muzzle is not worn for the animal's sake, but for the sake of the field's owner. So there's a few halachas about animals, but our time is definitely going to be up. And let's just take the opportunity to wish you all, first of all, thank you all so much for joining the show today at this late hour. And I want to wish every single one of you a beautiful, beautiful Shabbos. It should be a warm Shabbos. It should be a geschmackle Shabbos. It should be an inspired Shabbos. It should be a Shabbos of learning, of menucha, of kedusha. To each and every one of our radio family, I wish a Shabbat Shalom, a good Shabbos to one and all.